Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
אנחנו מתחילים ברגע זה ממש את פרק 188 בפודקאסט. מה שלומכם? איך עובר עליכם החג? איך היה בליל הסדר? האם מצאתם את האפיקומן? טוב, צריך להודות על האמת, זה לא חג לכל החגים, והאווירה היא מאוד ספציפית. אבל אנחנו איתכם בפרק גם במהלך החג הזה, והפרק הזה לראשונה מזה 188 פרקים, בשפה האנגלית, כי נמצא איתנו אורח מארצות הברית בשם דן סינור. היי דן.
Hello, Nadav. Good to be with you.
So, very good to be with you. Thank you for coming to our humble studio here in Tel Aviv.
It's a beautiful studio. It's yes, much better than my studio.
Much. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Now I feel flattered.
Yeah, it's like legit.
So let's just start with a little bit of a background about our guest, because beyond the fact that Dan hosts one of the most prominent, I think, and popular podcasts in America today, Dan is also well known and, you know, I can say highly experienced and appreciated figure in the American political media scene. He was like a short bio, so he was the spokesperson for the coalition forces during the United States war in Iraq 2003. He was a senior advisor to Mitt Romney, the Republican candidate for presidency in 2012. He writes columns in the Wall Street Journal, among other outlets. And, very important, he's married to Campbell Brown, well-known journalist in the United States, a father of two sons. And I think he's responsible for one of the most flattering nicknames that is attached to the state of Israel in the last 15 years or so, I guess. Startup Nation. Yeah, so this is the title of the book that you co-authored with your brother-in-law,
Saul Singer,
learned, yes,
who's in Jerusalem, who I just left a few minutes ago, or an hour ago.
So, Saul, your brother-in-law, he wrote with you Startup Nation, and just recently, the two of you wrote another book, which came out shortly before October 7, called The Genius of Israel. Yeah?
Yes.
So thank you for coming.
It's great to be here.
And
thank you for having me.
Yeah, I hope I introduced you properly. I did my homework well.
More or less.
Yeah, I think.
It was just amusing to me that you mentioned Campbell's name a sentence before you mentioned Startup Nation, because it reminded me that when we were kicking around the idea for the book, Startup Nation, everyone thought it was a good idea except Campbell.
Why?
Because she thought, she basically, as I described it to her, which was on a walk down West Broadway in Tribeca, which is where we were living at the time. We were walking to a diner, and I walked her through the concept of the book.
When was that, around, like?
2000. The book came out in November, fall of 2009. So this was like 2007.
All right.
Maybe 2006. And we're walking down West Broadway, and I said to her, you know, I got this idea for a book, and I'm walking her through it. And she basically heard in it that it was an economics book about Israel. And she thought there'd be nothing like more boring than an economics book about Israel. And so she said, I don't think anybody will buy it. Well, you should still write it, but know that nobody will buy it. And that just, if you're comfortable knowing, it'll be on the dorm rooms bookshelves of your two sons, and that's about it. And we'll have a copy in our living room at home. But that's it. It's not going to have a real market.
But
she was wrong.
No, I'll give her the fact that indeed, when thinking about book about Israel that is dealing with economics, this is not something which is, you know,
front and center.
And I think maybe some portion or large portion of the success of the story is the title.
Yeah, yeah, it's interesting. I do think the title, because it was a double entendre, which is, it meant two things, right? It was, we were saying that Israel was a nation of startups, highest density of startups in the world.
Who thought of the title?
I did. I'm proud to say. Yeah. But trust me, Saul had many other very important contributions.
So. Yeah, yeah.
But we joke about it all the time. It was a startup nation, a nation of startups, and that this whole country, this amazing, crazy country, was a startup itself. The whole idea, the whole founding of the state, everything about it was a startup. Even today, it's still, even with all its strength and power and mistakes, so in many respects, it's a very normal country, and yet it still feels like it's a startup.
You've always been like a frequent flyer to Israel?
Yes. My father, who's passed away when I was young, my father worked for the Weizmann Institute of Science and in North America, and he worked for Israel Bonds, selling Israel Bonds in North America. So he was always coming to Israel back and forth, and I would go with him all the time.
To Rehovot.
Rehovot. I spent a summer in Rehovot with him in a dorm room with him when I was a kid, when he was working in Rehovot. When I was like, now Rehovot is, you know, bustling. Rehovot has hundreds of these food tech startups, all these food tech startups.
I would never imagine we'll speak about Rehovot in this episode.
But we will do it right now for 30 seconds. So no, one of the amazing stories of Startup Nation is all these sectors, not the book, but what's happening here, all these sectors are blossoming out of nowhere. And one of them is food tech, all these alternative. And that whole scene, most of it is concentrated in Rehovot because it's all these like biologists who come out of,
affiliates of the Weizmann Institute.
They're all these scientists that come out of Weizmann and they go start their companies there. But when I went to Rehovot, it was, let's just say, not bustling. Not, I'm not saying it's bustling now. But he would come all the time. I would go with him. And he was very involved with Israel. My mother's a Holocaust survivor. She always was very invested in Israel and cared a lot about Israel. So they raised us with this real connection to Israel, and we were constantly spending a lot of time here when I was growing up. And then two of my sisters made Aliyah.
Mm-hmm.
So I have one sister today who lives in Netanya, who has three sons, and I have another sister who's Saul's.
You're almost a local.
Yeah, my other sister, Wendy, lives in Jerusalem, and she has three daughters. And so we're a very close family. My sons, who are teenagers, are very close with all their cousins. And so we're here all the time.
Have you ever thought of making Aliyah also?
No, because my life is pretty settled in the United States, but I've always assumed I would spend a lot of time here. I spent a year studying here, a little over a year at Hebrew University when I was in college. And I spend a lot of time here, and I think I'll spend more and more time here. I'm here probably every 2 to 3 months.
How many times did you visit here since the war started?
This is my third trip.
Okay, so here's the question. And try to be here now like an outsider observer, okay, for that matter. Try to describe the evolution that you have witnessed in those three times that you were here. When was the first time?
The first time was, I can't remember the exact date. It was between 2 and 3 months after October 7th.
Okay.
The second time was about a month ago, 4 to 6 weeks ago. And then the third time is now.
And do you see some kind of evolution yes. that is taking place?
Yes. The first time I was here, it was still in the mode of... So let me take a step back and say, when we wrote our book, our most recent book, not Startup Nation, The Genius of Israel, we kept updating the book as we were writing it because it was a book about Israeli resilience and the solidarity of the Israeli people. That's what basically the book was, and a book that was almost like a playbook for the West, a model for the West, for other Western countries, because most Western
how
countries...
How to operate a nation.
At a societal level. So basically, most of societies in wealthy Western democracies are falling apart, right? Birth rates are collapsing. People are high, the loneliness rates are very high. What they call deaths of despair in the United States, which are deaths as a result of suicide, drug overdose, alcohol abuse, those numbers are skyrocketing. Teen mental health crises, teen suicide rates. So the CDC says right now in the United States, we have a teen suicide crisis. As a father of two teenagers, just that whole term, teen suicide, the idea that there's unprecedented levels in America today of teens either taking their lives or trying to take their lives. I can go on and on. Loneliness, mental health, drug abuse, people not having children.
And Israel is an exception.
So most, every Western country that is wealthy and democratic is heading in a bad place on any one of these metrics. The only exception to any of these metrics is Israel. So Israel is a Western-oriented country. It is a democracy, and it's a wealthy democracy. Israel's per capita GDP has basically doubled in the last 20 to 30 years. It's a booming economy. And yet it's the only country that's defying every one of these metrics. So most countries' populations are collapsing because they're aging and they're shrinking because people aren't having children. In Israel, as you know, people are having a lot of children.
Also among secular liberal
totally.
Israelis?
Absolutely. So the Haredim are...
Haredim and the Arabs are,
The Haredim are high, but actually their numbers are coming down, but they're still high. But they represent a small percentage of the overall contribution to the birth rate. The real, where Israel's an outlier is you have secular, radically secular Israelis who do what you do, or they work in television, or they work in tech. So they have more in common with people, their peers in Berlin or London or Silicon Valley or Los Angeles.
The most common number for this kind of typical family is 3 kids.
Exactly. And you sometimes have people with 4 and 5. But yes, the most typical number is 3. Their peers, like the people I just described, you take a techie from Tel Aviv and you say, okay, now go find your peer in LA.
Germany.
Yeah, or London or Berlin. 2 kids at the most.
Yeah.
Usually 1, often none. Okay. Before we came on, we were talking about Avi Yisakharov and Lior Raz. Lior Raz, okay? Lior Raz has four.
Both are friends of yours.
Yeah. Close friends. Lior has 4 kids. He had his 4th kid during COVID. You look at a guy like Lior and say, all right, now who's your peer in Gal Gadot? I mean, just use these people who look at their peers in LA. Most of them do not have 3 and 4 kids. So that's what makes it, that's
just statistics. Is it also typical for Jewish families in the States, for instance?
That's a great question. So the more religious they are, they tend to have more children. The more secular they are, the number tends to go down. But I often wondered about that. So for Israelis, they're outliers relative to their peers who are non-Jewish and their peers who are Jewish for the non-religious ones. So the question is, what we were trying to understand is, it's a demographic fact of life, or rule of law in every part of the world, that as countries' populations become more productive, more economically productive, they become less reproductive. As they become wealthier, they have fewer and fewer children. And there's a bunch of social sciences to why that's the case. The only exception is Israel, which is a country that's becoming wealthier and wealthier, and you don't have all these societal dysfunctions. People are having more and more kids. So and all those countries are very politically polarized. Israel's politically polarized too, as we'll know. We can get to that. But there's a sense in these other countries, including the United States, where I'm very involved with the politics, the political polarization is tearing the country apart. Mm-hmm. I mean, really tearing the country apart. You saw January 6th.
But this is a feeling that is valid here also.
So Yes, but, and this comes back to your initial question. My but is...
My initial question, just to remind, was the evolution that you witnessed since...
October 7th.
Yeah.
What I saw here after... We wrote our book, and we were saying Israel has... is incredible solidarity, incredible social resilience, all these metrics you see about these other societies falling apart. Israel's holding together. What can the rest of the world learn about Israel? Our publisher says to us, great, but you got to delay the publication. They got panicked in 2023 because they saw judicial reform. And they watched what was going on here in judicial reform. And he goes, they said, you guys sound crazy. You're busy talking about how Israel's a model for social solidarity and societal health, and this country looks like it's on the brink of civil war. I mean, first they came to us with other concerns. First of all, they said to us, you realize a month before your publication date, Britney Spears' book is coming out, her memoir is coming out.
What was the due date for your
the
publication?
The publication date was November 7th.
2023?
Yeah, 2023. Okay. But you had to submit it in the summer, the end of the summer. So it's not like we saw a month of October 7th, and then we put the book out. We put the book to bed, meaning we sent it to the publisher, at the peak of judicial reform. Literally, we wrote the author's note that's in the current edition of the book.
Like the summer of 2023?
When there was that vote in the Knesset where they voted on the, which clause was it?
Reasonableness.
Yeah. Reasonableness clause. And there was that big march from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. We literally had to write an author's note. We were constantly updating our book. So first our publisher said, you're competing with Britney Spears. I said, you know, I think it's a different...
I'm not sure it's the same audience. I'm not sure, but maybe I'm wrong.
I'm not worried, different audience. Then they said, the exact pub date, your book, is the same publication date as Barbara Streisand's memoir. Some overlap, maybe Streisand, Senor, you know.
This Jewish motif here, okay.
But then they said, no, our real concern is judicial reform. And we argued in the book that... It was like a stress test, judicial reform for Israeli society, which meaning it was a stress test for our thesis.
But put it in the perspective of Israel after the war.
Yeah, yeah. So then the book comes out, and I will tell you what I saw after October 7th was it, I'm not pleased by what I'm about to say, but I'm just going to say it. It validated the thesis of our book because the thesis of our book is Israel can get really divisive. Israel can tear itself apart at the seams. But ultimately, when it matters, the country comes together. And there's certain guardrails in this country that we don't have in the United States, that you don't have in the UK. And to answer your question, after October 7th, I saw that in extremis. I saw this country. I mean, I don't need to tell you. I saw this country where the government, Israel is a place with weak government institutions, but a strong society. And people... The government fell apart. The government collapsed.
But let me push you back here, because talking about the immediate weeks after this tragedy, no doubt there was a sense of solidarity and national loyalty and so on. This is not the situation right now.
I'm not sure you're right, but I'm happy to argue about it with you. So let me say, on my first trip after October 7th, I still felt the country was holding together. I've now done two more trips, and here's what I see. And you can tell me, you can quibble with it. I see a very unpopular prime minister. I see a very unpopular government. And yet, more or less... If you just look at the polling, and every conversation I have, whether with people, I talk to people in government here from different parties who play different roles, especially in the war cabinet, and I talk to regular citizens, and I don't find much disagreement on how to proceed with the war. So to me, the measure is, see, in the United States, when we say the country's politically polarized, we mean... Half the country fundamentally disagrees with the other half of the country about what to do about an issue. I mean, you see this in Israel, in the United States right now, on abortion. It's not about, well, we don't like the politicians, but we basically agree on the... They're tearing each other apart based on the policies. There's not real disagreement here on the core policies.
So here's my take. I think what happened here, I would say in the last months, okay, just to be more concrete, is that... A material, fundamental questions about this war started to be raised. And this something that almost was not present at the public discussion before, up to very recently.
But is the question about how we got into this war?
No, how do we get out of this war? How do we bring back our boys and girls and, you know, the kidnapped Israelis that are there?
Yeah.
Like a fundamental question. Are we going, you know, Bibi is talking all the time about the total victory.
Right.
Okay. Are we going to see one?
Mm-hmm. But that's a debate about what's possible. It's not a debate about what the objective should be. Right? So people are questioning.
But if the objective is not something within... If the objective cannot be reached,
yeah,
then maybe we need to think to recalculate our direction.
Fine. But my question is, you ask the average Israeli across the political spectrum from right to left. I've been struck by this because I've been following Israeli politics, obviously not as closely as you have, but I've been, as an American, I follow Israeli politics about as close as any American does. I talk to people on the right and the left and the center and the secular and the religious. I talk to all the different tribes all the time. And the perspectives on what the policy should be, what are the goals, what are the objectives? And I mean, judicial reform, peace process, no peace process, you know, be in Gaza, disengagement from Gaza. I'm talking about the early 2000s. It was like everyone had strong positions on what the policy aspiration should be. You ask the average Israeli today. Should Israel wipe out Hamas?
Totally.
Right. And can Israel resume to normalcy if the nucleus of a Hamas, of a future Hamas, is still sitting there in Rafah? They say absolutely not.
But I think what's the generates...
And I've never seen that before in Israel. I've never seen such a consensus.
What generates the public debate, like everything here, is Bibi.
You know, there's that famous line that Barack Obama quoted Martin Luther King, you know, the arc of history always bends towards justice. And a British friend of mine, I remember a year or two ago, said that in the UK, they joke that the arc of history always bends towards Boris, that every conversation in British politics always is about Boris Johnson. And that's how I feel, by the way, in the US about Trump. The arc of every conversation always bends towards Trump. Here we are in the third presidential election, you know, in 12 years, in which
you want to count the number of elections that Israel had with Bibi.
So I'm just saying it's a similar phenomenon.
It's double digit almost.
So Donald Trump has been the most dominant figure in. So everything is a reaction to Trump. Like he's the most. He just hangs over every election in the U.S. I mean, not every, but three elections, which is a lot. And so Bibi is the same. Plays the same role
even,
here.
Even more.
Okay, but. There's the difference is, to many Americans, Trump, it's not just the effect of Trump, the persona of Trump that is so polarizing. It's the policies of Trump. By the way, some policies I happen to agree with, but I understand that it's the package. It's the mm-hmm. it's the persona of Trump, and then it's the policies of Trump. I do feel right now with Bibi, it's a little different in that there's the persona of Bibi that is polarizing. And let's be honest, in parliamentary systems, prime ministers, it happened to Margaret Thatcher in the UK. She was extremely popular, most successful prime minister, I would argue, since Winston Churchill. And yet she was ultimately pushed out because she stayed too long. There's a reason why in the U.S. we have term limits, because there's a general sense that after 8 years, and I don't know if 8 years is the right number, there's a sense that prime ministers can stay on too long. But I think right now, and I didn't feel this way during judicial reform, but right now, it's not the policies of Bibi that are the problem. It's the persona of Bibi that is polarizing. And
okay.
And I want to make one other point, because I get into arguments with Americans about this all the time. People say Bibi is extending the war for political reasons. I hear this all the time. Is he just extending the war? So my response to that, and I'm not here as a, you know, spokesman for any politician in Israel. Suppose you believe that's true. Do you not also believe, I say, that if Israel doesn't finish this war, that what exists right now in Rafah would probably form the nucleus of Hamas 2.0, of the retakeover of Gaza by Hamas. And so if that's the case, then doesn't Israel have to deal with Rafah?
One will argue that what will keep Hamas alive is the fact that you, as a country, do not encourage any alternatives. Maybe, you know, putting PA instead of Hamas, the day after, you know?
Yeah, so, look, I know that what to do the day after is a source of a lot of debate here. I tend to be more sympathetic with the argument, but I'm open to others. I tend to be more sympathetic to the argument that it is very hard to get buy-in from a local Palestinian population in Gaza so long as they believe there's a chance that Hamas can reconstitute itself. And I believe what has been most upsetting for me, and I pegged the date, and I come to this full disclosure with more of an American perspective, but I believe the last few weeks up until Iran, the Iran back and forth, which we can talk about, but up until the Iran attack, counterattack, I saw a combination of a bad vote at the UN Security Council, which the United States, with the Biden administration, greenlit. They abstained.
After the WCK incident.
Yeah, they abstained, and I put that in air quotes. The 14-0 vote, and they knew it was going to pass. When they abstained, they weren't abstaining. They knew it was going to pass, and they let it pass. Then Chuck Schumer goes to the Senate floor, and he attacks the government of Israel in a very unprecedented way, in which no senator would do towards any other democracy. And then you have the daily comments by Vice President Harris talking about red lines and Israel's crossing red lines. And anyways, example after example. And I think from that moment to now, there is a sense that pressure is mounting on Israel. And now, by the way, you're seeing it on steroids right now at U.S. college campuses. Pressure is mounting on Israel. And so Hamas sits there and Hezbollah and all these enemies of Israel. And they say, wait a minute. Why do we have to do anything? We're just going to sit back and watch the pressure mount on Israel. And so I think that, again, if you're an average Palestinian, you're sitting there and you're in Gaza and you're thinking,
okay,
everyone's beating up on Israel.
Wait.
Let's wait. Yeah. And then Hamas is saying they're not going anywhere. So the whole idea about a day after, what's a day after? What is a day after plan in a world in which Hamas thinks they're coming back and many Palestinians think they're coming back?
Okay. Let's talk about America, because you just mentioned what's going on right now back at your home. You know, there are particularly stormy events that are taking place. I think we're talking about an unprecedented wave of protests that has unfolded in the, I think, past 10 days or so.
Yeah.
At the universities in the United States. How do you see what's going on right there?
Where do I begin? So let me talk at the personal level, and then I'll tell you a more macro. At a personal level, you know, my wife made some noise when we were leaving town for this trip. When we were, you saw it.
She created a lot of intention with her tweet,
which she didn't intend to.
Yeah,
but.
I think I have this quote here of the tweet, but go on. Yeah. I will find it.
So we're driving to the airport. We're at our apartment on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, and we're driving to the airport to Newark on Sunday in order to get in time for Monday for Seder at my sister's in Jerusalem. And she said, remember, just, I mean, I, the gist of what she said in the tweet, I don't remember it exactly, but she said something like, I'm on my way to Israel right now.
I'm on my way to Israel, where my two sons will be safer and feel more welcomed than they would be today on the Upper West Side.
Right. So.
More than a million views.
Is that true?
Yeah.
Jesus. More than a million views. Yeah. No, we...
1.2 to be accurate.
We landed here, and it was like, you know, when you go on a plane and it was like an explosion, and all these media are calling saying
she's a famous persona,
and they're saying, what does this mean? Are you feeling under threat? Are you moving to Israel? That was the other thing the press were all talking about. Are you moving to Israel?
And this was before the climax that we're seeing right now.
Yeah, well, it was on Sunday.
Okay. Yeah, all right,
but it's still bad. I mean, yeah. And so what's that about? It is true that we live near Columbia University. Now, we live south of Columbia University, so it's not like we're right there. But there is this sense, and I have felt this way, a version of what she articulated. I've been feeling a version of that since October 7th. So, like, I'll give you an example. You know Brett Stevens? He's a columnist for the New York Times. Anyways, he's a writer for the New York Times. And he came over to our apartment on October 8th because we were recording a podcast about October 7th. It was October 8th. Yeah, he came over on the Sunday. And he came over that evening. And he had just come from a protest in Times Square. He was coming from the protest to our apartment. And it was a protest blaming Israel for October 7th.
The day after.
Yeah, the day after. Blaming Israel for October 7th. And he came to my apartment and we were recording. So he goes, you know, I was going to write something about it, but it seemed so silly and small. And there was only a few people there and they seemed sort of inconsequential and irrelevant. So I'm not going to write anything about it. Little did he know, or I know, or anyone knew, that that message, even though it was quiet on October 8th, would wind up enveloping the world. And I felt at the time, as naive as it sounds, I felt at the time that most of the outrage of the world would be directed at those people who tried to massacre, who did massacre Jews. I thought the outrage of the world would be directed to people who massacred the Jews.
That was the situation back then.
I did not think the outrage would be directed at Jews for objecting to being massacred. And that's what happened. It like, within no time, but with later that week of October, so October 7th is a Saturday, Brett and I have that conversation on October 8th. Later that week, Harvard, the 32 student groups from Harvard put out this statement, explicitly condemning Israel for what happened on October 7th, never mentioning
Hamas. I
think
it was the very day.
Yeah.
By the way.
And then the Harvard University put out a statement that was sort of blessing that student's day. So it just, one thing after that, and I'm sitting there, and I'm watching this, and I'm thinking, what's going on? Like, this is sort of crazy. And then you start, and then the whole thing about the posters being torn down, the hostage images being torn down, and it was one thing after the other. And then we just start to see violence against Jews, increasing violence against Jews in the United States. To give you an example, I was just had lunch with Jonathan Greenblatt, who runs the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League that tracks anti-Semitism. He told me that in 2022 was the worst year for anti-Semitic violence in the United States. 2022.
But
the fourth quarter of 2023, the fourth quarter of 2023, meaning that the 3 months basically following
immediately after
were worse than all of 2022. So we start to see it. And then, so now fast forward to now, what's happening on the campuses, it makes the whole place feel very unsettled. Like it makes the whole country feel, not the whole country, certain cities in the country where these campuses are, it just adds to the level of discomfort. So it's starting to feel like things are becoming unglued. That's at a personal level. Do you want me to?
No, my question is if we're making a life easy by suggesting that this is something which is motivated by anti-Semitism, because, you know, for us as Israelis or as Jews, it might be convenient and some will say appropriate to label what's going on there as something which is driven by deep motivations of anti-Semitism. But is it really the case?
I think it is. And I hate to say it. So let's just take their language in good faith. Let's think about the language that the protesters are using. So now you could say it's ill-informed. You could say it's not what they really mean. Let's just say they're saying these things, so let's understand what they mean. So when they say globalize the Intifada. Now, as you and I know, the Intifada was literally a rebellion against limits on...
The core meaning of Intifada is resistance, armed resistance, I would say. Violent resistance.
Violent resistance, right. So when they say an armed resistance against the Israeli military, which when the Intifada started was occupying the West Bank and Gaza. And so it was resistance to the military, to a military occupation of quote-unquote Palestinian lands, okay? So what does globalize the Intifada mean? Does globalize the Intifada mean, so take this protest, this violent resistance against the Israeli military and globalize it. Where? where's the Israeli military operating around the world? You cannot, you literally, there are no Israeli military installations around the world. So it's not about violent resistance against Israeli installations or Israeli military officials. It's about violent resistance against Jews, Jewish supporters of Israel. So that's globalized the Intifada. Let's take another phrase that there were video clips that went viral just in recent days. Burn, burn, burn Tel Aviv to the ground. Yeah. Burn Tel Aviv. So what does that mean?
But then you have the most basic argument against this claim that a considerable portion of the minds, those barricading themselves on the lawns of campuses in Colombia and other universities, are Jews themselves. And they oppose Israel, and they oppose maybe they anti-Israel or anti-Zionists, but certainly not anti-Jews or anti-Semitic.
First, before we move, I wanted to answer that. Before we do, because as you were talking, I was remembered the one that I found most unnerving of these statements was there was this image of Jews standing there counter protesting in Colombia, and there's you saw this, and Qassam
point the Qassam,
this is your next target with an arrow, and Qassam, for our listeners, I guess your listeners know, I always have to say,
basically killed them,
but Qassam is the military wing of Hamas, so it's Hamas. This, you did one target on, you had one target on October 7th. This is your next target. I mean, it literally, it's incitement of violence. So my response to this,
and this is something that cannot be tolerated towards any kind of other population,
could you imagine, or the other chant, go back to Poland. That's another chant on the Columbia campus, go back to Poland. Could you imagine during the height of the George Floyd protests in the United States, after George Floyd was killed, and there was a serious debate in the United States about over-policing and heavy-handedness of police and whether or not there's a race-based, the race-based implications to American policing. Could you imagine on any college campus people telling blacks, protesting Black Lives Matter, protesting, saying, go back to Africa? If there were thousands of students chanting go back to Africa to black activists, do you think the university would say, well, it's free speech, it's a political debate? You would say this is race-based incitement of violence. So, and every example I'm giving you has a violent nature. These are not people saying we're fighting for Palestinian self-determination, we want a two-state solution, there should be a Jewish state, and there should be...
And then they show you this bunch of Jewish students sitting on the lawn of Colombia and making the seder over there.
You're talking about which? Of the critics of Israel? Or
the critics of Israel,
yes. So let's talk about that. So there's no doubt that there are some Jews, I think very misguided. I did a whole podcast episode on this with Rabbi David Ingber and Yossi Klein Halevi, who's a Jerusalem-based public intellectual, about the discussion going on inside America among American Jews. The reality of it, Nadav, is that this group of Jews criticizing Israel, they're loud. They're really, really loud. And they're really, really small. By any measure, you look at look at public polling. Look at polling of the Jewish community in the United States. It's overwhelmingly supportive of what Israel is doing in Gaza. Overwhelmingly. I'll send you the data. So
what's the portion?
It's 80s, 90% of Jews supporting Israel's policies in Gaza. And even of those who aren't 80 to 90, doesn't mean that they're where these kids are on the college campuses. They're somewhere not as right as where is right wing is, quote unquote, right wing as Israel's become. But this group that's standing, Jewish Voices for Peace, and If Not Now, these are these groups, these Jewish student groups that are criticizing Israel. They represent a minuscule percentage. They're loud. And what's so reprehensible is the coverage, the American media, the mainstream media coverage, is putting so much emphasis on these tiny percentage of Jews that have joined the anti-Israel protests, as to say some Jews think this, some Jews think that. So you take the New York Times, they literally had an article, a headline. You would think, I mean, we are watching right now the most scrutinized war in the history of the world. I mean, the last most scrutinized war,
is unbelievable.
The only one I can compare it to is the Vietnam War.
You think about Ukraine and Russia, after 2-3 months, no one cared.
Right.
And this war is generating so much attention.
It's getting more attention than Vietnam War. In the Vietnam War, 56,000 Americans were killed. Vietnam War, not to mention all the North and South Vietnamese that were killed, and Cambodia, and Laos. Okay? This is more scrutinized than that war. Now, imagine Vietnam War with social media. Imagine Vietnam War with TikTok. But be that as it may, it's the most scrutinized war. And so it is not, and so the protest movement and what's happening on these
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
College campuses. By the way, what's happening with these anti-Israel protests on the college campuses are not just about Israel. What we are witnessing, and we're going to, Alon and I were just talking, but we're going to do a couple podcasts on how this is representative of a general breakdown in these elite American academic institutions. I don't think it represents just a Jewish problem. I think there's a broader crack.
And this is not a process that started with this war, and not something that started even this decade. Take me to the root cause.
So, but what I want to say is, the crack up at these institutions is worthy of immense American political news coverage and analysis. And when the New York Times writes, some Jews on campus feel threatened or some Jews, as though there are some Jews who are supportive, some Jews aren't. Could you imagine? I mean, I'm giving you we come back to George Floyd, summer of 2020. Could you imagine the New York Times covering the protests over George Floyd as some blacks are concerned about over the debate over heavy-handed policing in the wake of the George Floyd killing, as though there are some blacks who think, say, no, there was a sense that this was a problem for most blacks. In any social or civil rights issue or period or moment, you are going to have a tiny percentage who may disagree with the mainstream, but the mainstream is the mainstream. And I'm telling you, as someone who's centered in the American Jewish community, the mainstream of American Jewish life right now is with Israel,
yeah,
and is freaked out by what's happening on these campuses.
Okay, but if we're trying to understand the deep root or the root causes, okay, for this kind of phenomena that is taking place right now, and trying to understand, because is this related to the inherent tendency of the academia to the left, or yeah, maybe the
deep... Meaning, how did we get here?
Yes. How did you get here? Maybe this is the involvement of Qatar by funding institutions and influence on curriculum.
I think that the core problem at most of these institutions, not all of them, and I should say that there are some institutions where that have performed well. I'll tell you a story. 2 weeks ago, I was in Michigan. I was at two universities in 24 hours. I was at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, and I was at Duke University in North Carolina. And the experiences couldn't have been – I was speaking at both places. At Duke, at Michigan, at Ann Arbor, I was speaking with – which is a huge population, close to 30,000 undergraduate students. I was speaking with Naftali Bennett. I was interviewing Naftali Bennett on campus. And the day of the event, they had to quote-unquote cancel our event because the system had been hacked and anti-Israel protesters were planning to swarm and try to shut down the program. They had to move us to an undisclosed location. And an undisclosed location and do an event for, instead of in front of hundreds or a thousand people, we had to do it for 75 handpicked Jewish students. They found quiet, and then they live streamed it out to everyone else. I thought to myself, here we are in 2024, and a former Jewish prime minister, not particularly radical prime minister, by the way, the one who—
In the middle of America.
In the middle of America. The one who had led perhaps the most pluralistic government in modern Israeli history, that included an Arab Muslim leader as one of the key parties in the government, and he has to go to an undisclosed location. It's just insanity. And that was on a Sunday. And then on Monday, I go to speak at Duke University. Duke University, zero tolerance for this mishigas. Zero. The school just doesn't tolerate. There I gave a talk. 400 people showed up. No protests. No problem. One of the professors there, Frank Bruni, who's a professor who's also a columnist for the New York Times, he's not Jewish. He interviewed me. He asked me some tough questions. It was respectful. The students were great.
So what makes the difference?
The administration. The administration says—
Within the campuses.
Yes. The administration at Duke says, we're not tolerating this. We work closely with the Jewish group, the Jewish Student Affairs. It's called Jewish
and
Student Library.
And it has nothing to do with the tendency to the left or the involvement of Qatar.
So the issue with the left. So, of course, Duke, like any university, has left-wing professors, but I don't think the administration tolerates it. That's the first part of it. Now, at some universities, whereas at Michigan, you have a faculty that is quite left, and I think that is the case at Columbia. By the way, you've seen at Columbia, the professors walked out in solidarity with the students protesting against Israel, which is like the craziest thing in the world, protesting the NYPD, the police, from coming in and removing the students. So over the years, at most of these universities, not all, the professors that have been hired and in many cases been given tenure, so it means they have lifetime employment and they can't be removed from their seats, are mostly been pretty radically left professors. And they and the presidents of these universities are scared of the professors because these universities—
But why do you need to become such a radical lefty or hostile to Israel in order to be promoted? What makes this mechanism work?
It's the reverse. I think most of these professors are very left. They're radically left, a lot of them. And it reveals itself in many ways. And so when they're asked about Israel, all the anti-imperialism, anti-settler colonialism, which I think is all
BS.
Bullshit. I can say that. It's okay, yeah.
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely.
I can't say it on my podcast.
You can say the F word. You can say whatever you want.
Okay. So the mind virus that's going on with these kids that they're being taught. At the peak of the Vietnam War, there were crazy protests in the United States during the peak of the Vietnam War. But if you look at what most of those protests were about, they were not about, there were some exceptions, but they were mostly not about sympathy with the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia or with the Viet Cong in Vietnam. They were protesting Americans, in their argument, being used as cannon fodder in the war in Vietnam. As I said earlier, 56,000 Americans being killed. They're like, why are these Americans going to fight? Now, I have a different view about the Vietnam War, but I respect.
They had
skin in the game. They had skin in the game. These are kids who either they knew young people who were getting killed for this war, or they were worried because there was a draft. They were worried they were going to get drafted to fight in this war. These kids today, that are protesting Israel, they have no skin in the game. They're not involved at all. And The basic facts are just insane. Facts are Israel, you know, settler colonialism, a bunch of Jews came
from.
You asked me, how do these professors get this way? I think these professors tend to be recruited from the left, so they're susceptible to the worst, most knee-jerk left-wing caricatures of any issue. And if you have a knee-jerk left-wing caricature...
Let's try to be productive here. What can be done? Let's say tomorrow a government in Israel or America, for that matter, wants to change the course of the stream and to challenge these trends. Okay, is it even possible?
Okay, so this is something I've been thinking a lot about, and I don't have quick answers. I will tell you, this is a debate going on right now with like every I'm in all these WhatsApp groups that have formed since October 7th. I call them the Can You Believe WhatsApp groups, like a million different WhatsApp groups, which is just people, Jews, sharing with each other the latest outrage. Can you believe this article from The Guardian? Can you believe what the New York Times said? And they're all outraged. And they all often come down on, we need to fight back on social media. We need to, you know, the critics of Israel have gotten so good on social media, they overwhelm us. This quantitative based algorithms, and these algorithms, there's billions of,
as if you can push it back.
Yeah, there's billions of
it's like a tsunami.
Yeah, there's billions of Muslims. I'm not saying all Muslims are critical of Israel, but there are literally 2 billion, close to 2 billion Muslims in the world.
But there is a concentrated effort,
and then there's all these critics of Israel, and there's only so much of us, and they're running. And even if there's not a concentrated effort, the numbers are overwhelming, and these mm-hmm. things are algorithms, and they feed all this. And we need a strategy to push back, and we need to tell our story.
So can it be done?
I'm not sure, and I'll tell you why. As I look back at the history, about every 80 to 100 years, there's some major rise in anti-Semitism. I took my sons yesterday with Campbell to go to kibbutz near Oz. Mm-hmm. We spent the morning down there. Went to the Nova Music Festival site. And we went to near Oz. Campbell and I were there a couple months ago. We went to Kfar Aza, but this is the first time that they had been to a kibbutz. My kids are teenagers, and my son said to me last night, I couldn't believe this. He said to me, I found it harder. This last summer, we took the whole family to the concentration camps in Europe because my mother's father was killed in Auschwitz. And we went with my mother and to my mother's hometown in Europe. And my 16-year-old son said, I found going to Near Oz today harder than going to Auschwitz last summer. And I said, I was shocked.
I can totally understand.
You agree with him?
Absolutely.
Why?
This is so vivid. This is so live. This is so present.
So Scott Galloway, who's this?
Yes.
Yeah. I had him on my podcast recently. He argued that he thinks the Hamas are worse than the Nazis.
Yeah, I heard him.
Yeah, he explained why. But I said to my son, so I asked him why, and he said a version of what you said. I'm getting all these messages from my kids who are taking the train.
So tell them that you're going too late because we still have a lot of walk in front of us.
We still have a lot? Okay. Yeah. This thing keeps buzzing. I'm going to turn. Maybe if I turn the volume down.
All right.
Okay. Sorry. My kids keep texting me on WhatsApp. Kids,
their priority.
Because they're arriving at the Tel Aviv train station. Anyways, so I said to my son, so why is this worse? Why was it worse for you? And he said, because he said in so many words, he said, as awful as the Holocaust was, it felt to me that it happened in like history, like it was a part of history, and that humanity has evolved. Humanity has modernized. These weren't his words, but I was listening to him. He meant
this
like
cannot take place again.
People are too enlightened now. It would never happen again. And what he watched at Near Oz is he said, this happened like right now, like right now. And it's the same barbarism, or as Scott Galloway would say, it's even worse barbarism. And so my response to that, Nadav, is like, this, if you look at, go back throughout history, in every century, I tell people to do this all the time when I'm speaking to audiences, to groups, I say, put into Google a century, pick a century, and type in the word anti-Semitism. So put in 20th century, 18th century, 10th century, 15th
century. Not mentioning 20th century.
Right, 20th century. Put in any century and put in the word anti-Semitism. And you will be floored by what you see. You'll be shocked by what you see. And so here we are, and it's just another one of those moments. And I don't know what the quote unquote pushback is. Like, I don't know if people are open-minded about, well, they just need to be convinced, and then they'll be convinced to be okay. I am increasingly of the view that our focus needs to be on two things. One, continuity. That is to say, we need to push back where we can push back, and we got to make sure that Jews continue being Jews and living Jewish lives and living in Jewish communities. I'm talking now more about the diaspora than Israel. that Jews need to say, I'm not just going to be fighting anti-Semitism. I'm going to be leading flourishing lives and I'm Jewish lives, and I'm going to be part of a Jewish community, and I'm going to give my children and my grandchildren the joys of Jewish
life.
But
this comeback of anti-Semitism to the you know, public presence in the U.S. is not something new. I think I would say it was very it was illustrated very well in 2017 in Charlottesville. Then it came from the right. Okay.
Yeah. But it was nothing. That was nothing compared to what we're watching now. Yes. We saw anti-Semitism from the right. But here's the thing. Anti-Semitism from the right can only go so far. The problem with anti-Semitism from the left, and I was worried about Charlottesville. I wasn't just worried about Charlottesville. I was worried about what I saw all over social media around Charlottesville, before Charlottesville, right after Charlottesville. That was largely coming from the right.
The rising of Trump brought with their, a rising of anti-Semitism.
But the anti-Semitism, that anti-Semitism was awful and it was toxic, but it didn't have a real policy objective. Like when you would talk to these crazy people on the right, you'd say, so therefore what's, okay, your policy is what? And they don't really have a policy. It's just,
and those guys want to annihilate our country,
right,
our state.
The anti-Semitism from the left has a very clear policy objective, which is, they say it, from the river to the sea. I mean, why Israel's genocide, send them to The Hague. You know, the U.S. government should stop sending aid to Israel. So it has a real policy.
By the way, how this is perceived by the average American, like not necessarily by people who hate progressive movement and aligned with a populist right, but the average supporter of the Democratic Party, non-Jews, or among independent voters, how do they view what's going on campuses?
I think that most mainstream Americans, including mainstream Americans on the left, they don't care about Israel. They're not hostile. They're not friendly. They just don't care about it. They're not thinking about it. It's not in their daily, consciousness. They're more watching what's happening to Jews on campuses and see it as a proxy for breakdown in American society, that the whole country's coming apart, that there's a breakdown in order. That's because generally there's a sense that things are less secure, things are less orderly.
So in a way, this kind of demonstrations are creating like the boomerang effect in terms of public opinion.
Totally. I think Joe Biden has two or three really big vulnerabilities heading into his reelection, and this is one of them. The sense that he can't get control.
Sense among independent voters?
Independent voters. And I think that I have said this many times publicly. I've told some of my friends this who are in the Biden, campaign circles. I think that the opportunity for Joe Biden, opportunity, not pressure, the opportunity for Joe Biden is to confront this stuff head on. He gave a statement the other day. He issued a statement on Sunday about what's happening in Colombia. It's the first time he's spoken out about this rise in anti-Semitism, and it's the first time, thank God, he didn't say, I'm speaking out against statements against Jews and all other forms and Islamophobia. And he always has to caveat it with all these other things. The first time he was very clear, these are attacks against Jews. I think he should do more of it. I think he should confront it head on. I think he should say this is unacceptable.
Just for his own political...
It's a winner.
Yeah.
It's a winner. In 1992, when Bill Clinton was running for president,
Then he will lose the Muslims in Michigan.
Where are they going to go? They're going to vote for Trump?
They won't vote for Joe, and Michigan is a very important state.
Here's the problem. First of all, I don't believe if the Biden calculus is we run the risk of losing voters on the left, I would say those voters, if Trump is on the ballot, those voters are turning out, and they're not turning out to vote for Trump. They're going to be more freaked out about Trump than they will be about what they think is Biden's lackluster sympathy for the Palestinians. A. B. It's not, it is in a sense a zero-sum game. In other words, you can't say, oh, I'm going to pander to them and not worry about these other voters. In other words, at some point, Jewish voters are going to be concerned. So you mentioned Michigan, right?
Because Michigan is a swing state. And
there's a large Arab population.
It can do the make or break for Biden. And this particular Arab population within Michigan if they decide not to vote to genocide Joe, quote unquote, he may vote the general elections.
Yeah. The flip side is there's a few hundred thousand Jews in Michigan, Jewish voters who are in counties like Oakland County outside of Metro Detroit. And the Democrats just assume that most of them are going to vote Democrat. Or you take Pennsylvania. Biden can't win re-election without winning Pennsylvania. You talk to any Democrat involved with Biden's campaign, they say he has to win Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
Okay.
Think no Democratic nominee won without Pennsylvania.
Pennsylvania. So in 2020, about a little over 7 million voters in Pennsylvania voted in the presidential election in 2020. They estimate approximately 300,000 of them were Jews, Jewish voters, about 300,000 out of 7 million.
And their representative in the Senate is the most outspoken.
John Fetterman.
Yeah.
It's incredible. Incredible.
He's not Jewish.
No, he's not Jewish. And he's totally, and his numbers, by the way, are much stronger in Pennsylvania than Biden's, and he's a Democrat. So if Pennsylvania's most of those Jewish voters are concentrated in the Philadelphia suburbs. Most of them vote Democrat. The Democrats are just assuming they're all going to vote Democrat. If they feel that Biden is pandering to these crazy left-wingers who are like fomenting pogroms on U.S. college campuses, they could lose a bunch of these voters.
I saw this tweet from Bill Ackman, basically said, if you think I'm going to vote for Biden, you need to think again. And he's a very relevant voice within the Jewish community.
Every day I get these, I'm going to read you. I mean, I literally, since we're pulling up our favorite tweets, I'm going to read.
Just use the mic.
Yeah. Sorry. Hold on. So this is one. And he said this publicly. So I feel that I can say, I can quote from a friend of mine. I can find it. Friend of mine named Josh Wolf, who is a venture capitalist in Israel. He's a venture capitalist in New York, very successful venture capitalist. I always view him as a moderate, maybe center-left guy. I really don't know what his partisan politics are. But, you know, here he is. He's got a venture fund called Lux Capital. He's got 150,000 followers on Twitter. And he says, and he quotes a reform rabbi, who's always been a very liberal guy, Ami Hirsch, who's raising these concerns that we're talking about now. So Josh Wolf quotes from Ami Hirsch, and then Josh writes on Twitter, he says, I cannot tell you how confounded I have been over how many people I love and respect have committed to fund and vote Trump on this issue, meaning on Israel. I would have lost it on them October 6th. I can't believe I'm saying this, just as I can't believe what I've seen happening in our cities. I get it. Meaning he's saying, Josh Wolf is saying, I cannot, on October 6th, I would have told these people, you're crazy for supporting Trump. And now he's saying, I get it. I can't believe I'm saying this, but I get it. And if you have enough people who say, I get it, he's saying it out loud.
So the key for victory to Biden is to centralize himself in terms of the way he
I think the bet he needs to make is the bet Biden needs to make is most of the left will ultimately be there for him. If Trump is on the ballot, most of the left will be there for Biden.
Or the worst won't come to vote.
Yeah, although that's bad for him, but yes, that is a risk. But the bigger risk to him is the Jewish voters in some of these swing states.
And the independents.
Stay home. And then those independents who aren't Jewish, but are watching the balagan, they're watching the craziness, and they're saying, you know what, I need someone to restore order, and Joe Biden's not the guy to restore order.
A different angle. So to what extent is the perception and general attitude towards Israel in America is influenced by the attitude towards Bibi personally?
I think for most Americans, they don't personalize it. They don't think Bibi, no Bibi. They're just not that close to it. I think among many on the left and many sort of professional Democrats or professional liberals, people who work in politics, work in government, work in the media, it's very personalized to Bibi.
Mm-hmm. Obama administration veterans.
Exactly. And I think they go out of their way now. I think Biden and some of his advisors think they can pick fights with Bibi publicly, and it serves their purpose of pandering to their left by mm-hmm. fighting with Bibi because their base doesn't like
and
Bibi.
And make the distinction between their treatment towards Bibi and the treatment towards Israel.
Right, except I think it's backfired. because they have had a two-pronged strategy, which is to privately provide Israel with all these munitions and arms and get Israel everything it needs, while at the same time fighting with Bibi publicly. The problem is...
No, but let's admit, because I think it would be fair to say that in America, he's being perceived as almost an internal player. It's not like just a foreign leader. He's a household name.
Yeah, but I'm saying it doesn't work. The strategy doesn't work because... people over in this part of the world, in the Middle East.
He endorsed basically Mitt Romney.
He did not endorse Mitt Romney.
He did his very best in order to help him be elected.
Okay, that is completely overstated.
And then he went behind the back of the president, allied with the GOP on the Hill.
About Iran.
In the Congress, behind the back of the president.
So let's take those apart. First of all, he did not endorse Romney. He hosted Romney. Any nominee of any party in any presidential election comes to Israel during the election. The prime minister is going to host them, and if Obama came, he would host them. Like, it's the prime minister's responsibility. One of these two men could be president of the United States. You can't. It's not endorsing. It's that you roll out the red carpet for any major political leader, whether they're the incumbent or the challenger, to treat them respectfully when they come here. As it relates to the Iran going before Congress, I mean, we can debate. I mean, it turns out he was right. It was a bad deal. The Iran deal was a terrible deal.
Bibi generates emotions in America almost the way he creates emotions in his own country. In a way, Emmanuel Macron or Schultz or even Putin. No, in terms of, you know, personal involvement of people in America.
I think
it's something which is very non-typical for a foreign leader.
I think the issue of Israel generates emotions in American politics the way no other country's positioning in the geopolitical ecosystem generates. People in the United States are not having debates about France. They're not having debates about Canada. That's not just because Macron and Justin Trudeau manage their relations differently. It's that these countries, in the scheme of things, according to most Americans, don't matter. It's not a dig against those countries. They just don't matter. Israel matters to Americans for a whole variety of reasons. Shared strategic interests. They're fighting crazy Islamic extremists all over the world, whether it's ISIS or Al-Qaeda or Hamas or Iran. It's based on religious connection, shared Judeo-Christian values, that this is the homeland to the Jewish people, and it's the country protecting all these religious Christian sites, that all these religious evangelicals and Catholics feel so strongly. I mean, Israel plays a role in American life the way no other country plays. Now, does that mean that, and by the way, I remember, as I mentioned on my podcast recently, I go back and look when Shimon Peres was prime minister, when Yitzhak Rabin was prime minister, anytime they did something wrong, you had all these same columnists, Thomas Friedman, all these columnists attacking Shimon Peres, attacking Yitzhak Rabin, using the same language. They did this to Golda Meir. Golda Meir famously had this amazing line where she said,
The second American Israeli prime minister. Golda was the first.
Right, but Golda had this great line about the American press. She said, I'd rather take a bad news article than a good obituary. Meaning, Israel's always taking heat from the American press and often from various players in American politics. And yes, Bibi may even have more of an effect, but it's not like Bibi out of nowhere. You can't compare, say, well, there's Bibi and there's Justin Trudeau, and they don't get mad about Justin Trudeau. Because Americans don't have debates about Canada. It's not like people are storming the streets of Colombia, the Quad in Colombia to debate Canada.
I think one of the best examples is the way America looked at what happened here during 2023. And they view what happened before October 7th regarding this judicial overhaul that Netanyahu promoted. And they covered this, you know, enormously.
Because there's coverage of what happens in Israel, no matter what the issue is, in ways that there's just not coverage of domestic affairs anywhere else in the world. So that there's so much going on there, like in that exact question. Again, why is this the most scrutinized war in the world?
Because it's not because of Bibi. It's taking place in the most scrutinized country in the world.
Right. So that Okay, that's one argument. I agree with that. I think that's part of it. It's not the only part of it. But I'm just saying you can't pin that on one political leader. Again, I get that Bibi has outsized he's an outsized impact on political debates here and everywhere. But Americans' obsession and the West's obsession with Israel predates the rise of Bibi.
Yeah. Something which I'm curious about, with respect to what happened in Israel during this judicial reform, judicial overhaul, and you know, I wonder what you saw in America. Was that, you know, the country that is on the path of losing its democratic identity because of you know, conservative and religious forces that are becoming more dominant, or perhaps, you know, you saw the contrary, and this unprecedented pushback, the massive objection led by the liberal camp's protest against this overhaul, only emphasized in your eyes, or in the outsider's perspective, you know, the image of Israel as a liberal and pluralistic democracy.
I think that I'm not a participant. I'm not a direct participant in this, in the implications of these debates. I watch them closely. I care about them, but I'm not.
Because you're not a real outsider.
I watch them closely. I'm not as an Israeli citizen. I'm not going to be before an Israeli court, God willing. But my sense, just analyzing it from afar, is that Israel was badly in need of judicial reform, that the judiciary had become way too powerful here relative to other parts of the government. And so there needed to be reform. But do I think it made sense to unleash this massive agenda on judicial reform, you know, within, you know, days after the new government was sworn in, and trying to pass it all very quickly? And do I think, you know, without consensus building.
But what kind of Israel emerged in the eyes of Americans when they saw what happened here?
That's a great question. I thought most Americans I spoke to about it, and this is anecdotal, so it's not based on public polling, but most Americans I spoke to generally felt that what was going on in Israel was impressive. And it was impressive in this sense. You had a government that came in with a very ambitious agenda within days of it being sworn in, that had not built a real consensus for its reform agenda. And there was public pushback. And the public pushback was both ferocious but not violent. It was.
And it made a difference.
Yeah. Well, it was ferocious but not violent. It was not destructive. It was not vandalism. It was basically peaceful protests every Saturday night, not far from here. And not just here, also in Jerusalem and other parts of the country. And it was singularly focused on one issue. It didn't become a grab bag of every issue. Oh, Palestinians, oh, this issue, that issue.
The identity of the country.
It was about, right, it was specifically about the judicial reforms, and it was patriotic. People were waving Israeli flags. They were singing Hatikvah. It was a celebration of Israel. It was in defense of Israel. It was not an indictment of Israel. And I think many Americans saw some of the protests from the left in the United States against Trump, against others, that the whole debate became not just about the politician, but an indictment of America, as though somehow the original sin of America was America. It was the founding of America, and it was founded on unfair terms, and that what we're watching today is just a modern incarnation of that. In Israel, it was a celebration of Israel. These were Zionists. These were patriotic Israelis. These were people who served in the army. And so I think people found it moving, and it made a difference. And literally, it provoked the government to reverse course.
I think we need to wrap up soon because your kids are
My kids are going to be stranded at Haganah.
Yes, but,
at the train station.
As I told you before we came into this studio, what can happen, okay?
Yeah.
They're in a foreign country. They don't speak the language. In the middle of a war, what can happen?
And my wife said, it's better here than the Upper West
exactly.
Side. It's not like they're sitting there at
Let's
Columbus.
Let's talk about Call Me Back, and then I will let you go.
Okay.
So we're talking about your podcast, which is on the air for 4 years now?
I started it sometime in COVID. So, late kind of late 2020.
But it can be said that since the war began, your podcast has mainly focused what's going on here and became a hit.
So since October 7th, we have focused exclusively on what's happening in Israel.
As an editorial decision.
Yes. I mean, we just knew we had to talk about Israel and explain what was happening. And we didn't say we're going to be on 6-7 months later and we're still only going to be talking about Israel. To be honest, we didn't know where this all would be.
But there is a demand. Later.
Yeah, yeah. So we just started almost, you know, some weeks, first few weeks we were doing 3 or 4 times a week. Now we're doing 2 to 3 times a week, 2 to 3 episodes. Almost all of our guests are Israeli, usually Israeli journalists.
You had Ron Dermer?
Ron Dermer on, yeah. So we've had a couple.
He never gave any kind of interview in Hebrew.
Yeah.
You know, I personally heard him speaking Hebrew. I can give a testimony that he speaks Hebrew.
He speaks Hebrew.
But a lot of Israelis have no clue.
I was surprised the reaction here to him giving that interview. I didn't expect, there was a lot of reaction here to that, right? That he never...
He is very important figure and people don't know him at all.
Yeah, yeah. So I've known him for a long time.
The closest guy to Netanyahu, I guess.
Yes, he's definitely.
His family.
Yeah, and so I asked him if he wanted to do it while I was in town. I was in town. It was my last trip, and he had me come to where he works, to Balfour, you know, the Prime Minister's office, and we did an interview there. And I thought he was pretty candid. He talked a lot about Rafa, and this then provoked Blinken to respond to what Ron had said in the podcast. But also, I interview a lot of Israeli journalists from the right, from the left, So here's who I think I'm speaking to in this podcast, and why I keep it going. I hear from 3 groups of people. One group of people are American Jews and Jews from, you know, the West, the diaspora, who just feel like it's helping them stay informed in a non-official way. I'm not an official of the government. I'm just trying to bring on guests from Israel who can explain what's going on. 2, I think I'm reaching a lot of American journalists. A lot of American journalists listen to my podcast. These are not people who are cheerleaders for Israel, but they're not hostile to Israel. They don't wake up every day yelling at Israel, and they don't wake up every day loving Israel. They're just, they know it's complicated and they want to learn. And my podcast has become a source for them to get educated. And then I would also say there's this interesting group of people around the world who are listening. Like I've met with recently with Saudi officials, senior officials from Saudi Arabia. They listen to the podcast regularly. Yeah. I said, and they quote the podcast to me. Quote different episodes. So I said, why? Why are you listening to you in Saudi Arabia? Why are you listening? They said, because we want to understand the conversation happening inside Israel. We don't hear.
Yeah. And I will give you my personal note here. I'm very happy that your podcast became such a hit because I think it brings this complexity to the table that is basically you cannot find it. And this is something that they cannot understand just from TikTok or mainstream media.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, that's exactly, again, I don't even agree with all my guests. I have these guests on and sometimes they say things and I'm, you know, I don't want to fight with them on every issue because it's almost besides the point. The point is it's complex. People have strong views. They have intelligent analyses from inside Israel. And I want my guests, I want my audience to hear those discussions, to hear how Israelis are wrestling with these very complicated issues.
How many listeners do you have?
I don't know. You got to ask Alon. But, you know, I tried not to, when my wife was at CNN.
But you are ranking in a very flattering.
Like we're in the top for U.S. news, for commentary in the U.S., news commentary. We were, as a week or two ago, in the top 10 of all podcasts for.
So we're talking about millions of listeners.
I guess. I don't know. The reason I say I don't
good
know
for
is,
you.
Is when my wife was at CNN, when she worked at CNN, they used to tell her every minute, oh, look at what our rating was every minute. We got, you know, this rating. We lost audience when you did this guest, when you did that guest. And they get in these, you're on TV. I mean, they get in people's heads about you can't, this segment works, that segment doesn't
Everything
work.
Is calculated.
I don't want to do that
yeah.
because I want to bring on guests who I think tell the story of what's going on in Israel right now. And I don't want to sit there.
By the way, this is the beauty of this medium.
I agree.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're doing it too. It's like you can just, you choose your guest and it'll find an audience or it won't. But it's, but at a minimum, you get, we get to have interesting conversations.
So I think this is the point I need to let you go to your kids.
You think?
I think, look, I don't want to feel any kind of blame upon myself.
I mean, okay? My wife said they're safer here. Yeah. So they're safer here than the Upper West Side. So let them experience that.
But let's
that
not
safety.
Take it to the extreme, okay? Dan Sinner, it was a pleasure that you came here. Thank you very much for
Thank
coming.
You.
It was great having you here. תודה רבה לכם שהייתם איתנו. זה היה פרק 188 בפודקאסט, ואנחנו, אני אנסה להביא מוסף בהמשך השבוע אחרי ההג השני, ואני אתכן, אם יהיה אתם תעודכנו, וגם אם לא יהיו, כנראה שתשימו לב. זהו, ביי ביי, להתראות.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With ACAST, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee. Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. And they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.